It's review night and we'll begin with TV. We head to New York City for season 3 of And Just Like That to find out what's happened with Carrie, Miranda and Charlotte as they navigate life and love in their 50s. Then we head to Nottingham in the year 2000 for the latest BBC drama, What It Feels Like for a Girl, a bold coming-of-age drama about a queer teenager stuck in a working-class town. And finally, we have Department Q, a new Netflix crime thriller based in Scotland and starring Matthew Good as a detective who is racked with guilt following a shooting that left his partner paralysed and another policeman dead. Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon are here and they've been stuck to their screens watching all of this for us. So we'll jet off to the Big Apple first. Sarah Jessica Parker, Cynthia Nixon, Kristen Davis are back juggling it all in their 50s. When we left them in series 2, Aidan had just left Carrie to care for his son who was struggling with his mental health. Jen, so where do we find Carrie and Aidan? Where do they stand, that relationship stand?
I have to say, this has been the weirdest conceit, I think, ever when we left them in the last season, because you had Aidan very worried about his son, Wyatt, who felt it was going off the rails and he had to go home. And that's fair enough. You understand. He had to go back to Virginia, be there for his family. But at the same time, he made this, you know, he said no contact between him and Carrie. There's been no contact between them and it just bought this wonderful house together and you felt like it was...
And for something like 5 years.
Yeah. Until the child is now, like he's supposed to be, I suppose, 13, 14, I think. Yeah. And until he had hits 18, there was to be nothing between this pair that had just got back together.
And she agrees.
Yeah, without question almost, which also feels very strange. So you see her now and she's living almost like a lady from a Henry James novel. She's cooped up in this gorgeous house and, you know, restraining herself from glancing at several suitors that appear or would-be suitors that appear. And she's haunted by the thoughts of Aidan being away in Virginia. And you see them nascently starting their relationship back up and seeing if they can work this out and there can be more contact than there was supposed to be. But it is, I have to say, for the 6 episodes that I've watched, it is very caught up in Aidan's family life, which I have a problem with in the entire seasons of And Just Like That. I don't think we ever need to see these children. No. I don't want to know about Brady. I don't want to know
You're
about...
You're very Victorian in your views. You know,
it's not about them. It's not about Brady. It's not about Lily. It's not about Rock. It's not about Aidan's brood of boys. It should be about the main women. It should be about Charlotte, Miranda and Carrie. That's who we want to see, who we want to see all together. And even this kind of conceit of keeping Carrie and Aidan apart and putting them back together also feels a bit tiresome as it goes on. Where it comes
but
to life...
In truth, Aidan has got a bit tiresome, so maybe it is better to keep him away from the action. Chris, tell us about Miranda then and Charlotte. Where are they in their lives?
They're separated from Carrie, which is the biggest show, as Jen, or it's the biggest mistake, as Jen pointed out, that this show makes. I think actually these guys are much better together. That's what made Sex and the City work. But Miranda is off, busy with work, but also having various romantic misadventures. I think at times it seems like Michael Patrick King, who's the showrunner here, he's determined to see how many embarrassing romantic encounters Miranda can have before she finds someone who's actually suited to her.
Yes, because Miranda is gay. We knew her as being married to Steve in Sex and the City.
Miranda was married to Steve and then at the beginning of And Just Like That, their marriage had just become, they'd become more like roommates. There was no real romance between them and she came out after separating from Steve and she had a partner, Che, who we've just completely brushed over in this. Like, she was always, Che always felt like a bit of a character out of place in the show. Even the fans online weren't too crazy about that character who's just been completely written out. So this time we have her with Rosie O'Donnell. I won't spoil what happens with Rosie O'Donnell, but I will say
it's
never.
It's kind of cute.
It is very kind of cute. Never in a million years would you guess what happens there. But there might be a happy ending in store for Miranda. But with Charlotte, it seems at times, we've been discussing this before, that the show, the same way it's determined to embarrass Miranda in her love life, it almost seems determined to turn Charlotte into just an idiot. And she's not. You know,
In Sex and the City, she wasn't. But in the films, she became this one note. Park Avenue princess.
Yes, and a kind of one-note actress in the films as well, which she wasn't in the series.
And I think this has followed on now into And Just Like That, which is sad, I think, for Kristen Davis.
It's very strange because one of the storylines involves Charlotte running around town trying to have her dog uncancelled because her dog has been blamed of attacking someone. And you're thinking to yourself, this is Sex and the City or an extension of it. You know, the characters should be treated better. And it's a shame that we don't get to see her, you know, have better material, basically.
OK, well, let's get a clip which has all the three girls together. Carrie meets Charlotte and Miranda in a bar and they're asking how Aidan is.
Well, Carrie, have you heard anything from Aidan?
Oh, yeah, I got a postcard today.
A postcard? What did he write?
Nothing. I've been sending him vintage postcards of old New York.
To remind him you're getting old in New York?
With just a heart drawn on them. You know, just to let him know I'm here. I love him. And so now he's sending me back blank postcards from Virginia.
Aww. Blank postcards gets an awe?
Well, not an over-the-top awe, but it is sweet, and it's better than nothing. Listen, Aidan asks for no communication while he deals with his family stuff. I'm giving it to him.
As long as it's working for you.
I'm a big girl in a big city with a big house to furnish. I've got plenty to do up here while he figures stuff out down there. I mean, I have to wait 6 months for the fabric that I ordered for the chaise. It's on back order, and I love Aidan almost as much as I love that fabric. So, you know, it's like my relationship's on back order.
For 5 years?
Come on, 5 years.
So Sarah Jessica Parker there as Carrie, Charlotte played by Kristen Davis and Cynthia Nixon as Miranda in And Just Like That. So it seems like a bit of an extreme cabinet reshuffle, doesn't it? Where you're talking about, well, Big was got rid of very early on. Yeah. Then Shay, as you said, has disappeared. And Naya has also disappeared. Yeah. So then that leaves us with new characters that came in And Just Like That. This is Seema, the estate agent, and the filmmaker Lisa. What's happened them, Chris?
Yeah, so Lisa...
Are they still there?
They are still there and better. And their stories are infinitely better than Carrie, Miranda's and Charlotte's at the minute. Although it does feel like Lisa, otherwise known as LTW, it does feel like every time we get to her story and her family, who are great to watch and live in a beautiful home, it feels as though the show is saying, meanwhile, on the LTW show, which feels totally disconnected and apart from what's happening in Just Like That, she is making, LTW that is, she's a documentarian who's making a film on the history of 12... Black women who were incredible in their separate fields, whether it was the arts, politics, but haven't been celebrated before. And for some reason, her producers are pushing her to celebrate Michelle Obama, despite the fact that Michelle Obama has already been celebrated. So she's having a big problem with that. And then Seema is filling that very big, obvious Samantha-shaped hole in this series. And it felt as though any attempt to kind of fill that hole before was quite awkward. But I think Seema is actually starting to come into herself.
On her own. Yeah, she is.
Her love life is very
entertaining. Samantha, of course, was played by Kim Cattrall, and there was the famous falling out with Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yes. I also think with the Seema character, you're getting this different side of a story about what happens to a career-driven, powerful woman who is being pushed out of her industry because she has gotten older. And I think that's interesting, even if that story hasn't fully ignited yet within the six episodes.
It's a bit funny though. She's dating, but she's no patience with dating.
No.
She
exactly.
does, you know,
no.
She knows what she wants, and if she doesn't see it in front of her, she's off.
But she has spied the beautiful gardener played by Logan Marshall Green that's working in Carrie's house. So that may be something that happens. But there's also, for Carrie, maybe as it goes along, there's this fellow novelist played by Jonathan Cake, the British actor, and he is living in the basically the basement kind of house below her giant house. So there might be something there. You see them, you know, almost like it could be one of these enemies to lovers situations if we can get the whole Aidan situation out of the way, which might be nice because I want to see Carrie single. I'm very selfish. I liked her when she was single.
Now, the action in even Sex and the City, not to mind, And Just Like That, was never really Henry James. But what we loved was that coming together of the four women, as it was then in Sex and the City. Do we get those moments where they meet in a fabulous coffee shop or cocktail bar and discuss life?
There are some dinners.
Not enough.
They really. It is the biggest mistake that it makes, because this series, although there's still an awful lot wrong with it, for instance, Carrie trying to write a novel about maybe an imaginary woman who used to live in her building, and it sounds as though it was written by a teenager. It's very poor. Although there are signs of improvement, it needs to bring them all together, even bring Seema and LTW together, because that's where it really shines. I'm like Jen, I don't really care about the Aidan. I never cared about the Aidan character. They're fundamentally bad for one another. They never had anything in common. They never had any chemistry, the actors at all. It just felt like, oh, Big is gone and we definitely have to get rid of Big now. We can't even bring him back in flashbacks because Chris Noth turned out to be not a great dude in real life. life. So let's
Big
push.
Gone, never referred to.
Never
again,
referred to
which
ever
also
again.
Seems quite strange, given that huge connection that they had in the end of the original series, The Sex and the City. Even in the films, you just feel like it's been completely sidelined. She had her season of being a widow, and now it's just like it never happened. And that's what I find with this show. It feels like, I said it before, that there is a gas leak in the writers' room because the out of pocketness of some of the situations that the women are in, that find themselves in, storylines are dropped, characters are dropped, like the way, no reference to Che, and I know Che was an extremely divisive character, as you know, Chris was saying online, but it's like this Simpsons
Poochie. When you're gone, you're gone.
Poochie goes back to their planet, never to be referred to ever again. But I do, what I have to say I did enjoy about this season is the fact that the characters of Carrie and Miranda feel more like themselves. You heard in that clip where Miranda had that touch of cynicism about Aiden.
Yes.
This is what we want. Like in previous seasons, they felt completely different, not in relation to what we had seen over 20 years before. And we've lived with these girls for so long and you have a relationship
with
them.
You know, Jen and Chris, like, I think you're dying, you know, to hate it, but you just can't.
No, I can't. It's impossible.
So, stars out of five for And Just Like That, season three, Chris.
Oh, they can make this for 10 years and I'll still, like, they're terrific company, even when they're annoying. So I'll keep watching. It is a mild improvement, but as I say, get them all together, get rid of Aiden and get rid of the kids. We were both talking about this before. Nobody really cares. Those kids in this show are less believable as humans than sometimes Charlotte is, unfortunately, in this thing. So get rid of them, bring them all back together, and I might watch season four. Three stars.
Three stars. And from you, Jen?
I'm just so possessive. Like, I'm like a misguided Marvel fan about Sex and the City and the Sex and the City of the universe. I really love that show. And I think it's never appreciated as much as it should be. And I think this is missing the rhythms of that show. But I do like... It's set in a world that's so far away from reality, so removed from reality, they could be on Mars. But there's something very cosseting and comforting about that fantasy of this world. And there's a gorgeous montage of beautiful shoes. I love Sarah Jessica Parker.
You can't give it a low score. What
no,
are you going
Carrie
to
Bradshaw
it?
Is like my Don Draper. She's my Tony Soprano. She's my anti-hero. So, I mean, I think I'll give it three because I think it's the best one of And Just Like That we've seen so far.
Okay, well done. You came out with the score. 3 out of 5 from both of you for And Just Like That season 3. Now to the BBC's What It Feels Like for a Girl. It's a coming-of-age drama set at the turn of the millennium and based on Paris Lee's memoir. Byron is an unhappy 15-year-old stuck in a stifling home in a working-class town, yearning for freedom. This is Byron, played by Ellis Howard.
2000. Wages, living standards, life expectancy, everything's rising. Flights are cheaper, skirts are shorter, and the music never stops. Life's one big fucking party. You can wear what you want, be what you want, shag who you want. And everyone, everywhere, is having fun. Wild, unadulterated, grown-up fun. Except me.
Oh, poor Ellis Hart, and he's playing Byron. Chris, tell us about this new series from the BBC.
Yeah, so it follows the story of Byron. It's actually based on Paris Lee's memoir, but Paris Lee's memoir, What It Feels Like for a Girl, was also partly kind of a novel with fictionalised elements in there. So Byron is a 15-year-old from Nottingham who is young, very confident, very intelligent and queer. But, you know, his family and their family and their schoolmates won't allow them to be themselves, basically, you know. We have a dad played by Michael Soka who is very good here as Steve.
He's such a good actor, though.
He's never been bad.
Yeah, he's a fantastic actor and he's very good at playing fathers who are just very harsh on their sons. Mm-hmm. So he wants his son to be a man's man, to play football, to watch boxing and drink beer, but that's not what Byron wants at all. So Byron is just looking for a way out of Nottingham. That arrives first in the form of sex work where he meets some unsavory characters, some characters who he might actually fall in love with and that they might change their lives. And but it all changes one night in Nottingham when Byron comes across the Fallen Divas, who are a group of queer men and women who are mad about the Nottingham nighttime scene and kind of like teach Byron everything they wanted to know about what it means to be young, you know, at the turn of the millennium as well, and queer in the UK. At a time as well when everything was changing at such an alarming rate.
Yeah, Jen, do you get that atmosphere of the millennium?
Like, I mean, you're launched back into a world of, you know, Nokia 3310s, Bacardi Breezers, yeah. Gap jeans. You heard the Chemical Brothers there in the club scene, Discmans. It's just, but it's not this cozy look back at those pre-social media days. Although I did have to laugh, there is a great scene about dial-up internet visual gag in the first episode that's very, very good. I mean, it is set in that world and you feel that. I mean, I love any show where you see a young person walk into a nightclub and have that feeling of liberation and finding themselves on the dance floor, and you do get that here, and you see that in shows like It's a Sin or even Big Boys as well. But this is a very different equation. I mean, it's extremely hard hitting. I think that there is within Byron, because Byron is itching to break free of that punishing.
Yes, you can see from that clip what an attitude Byron has.
Yeah, that punishing life of, you know, the mundane life of that working class background where they don't fit in. But that leads to this acceleration into a more adult realm. And I think that a lot of viewers will identify with that, because those teen years are those times when your decisions making is under the influence of, you know, fizzing hormones, and your brain is trying to catch up with that, and the consequences of those situations that Byron finds himself in can sometimes be very difficult to watch.
Chris, you were saying that that Byron finds the tribe that they have been looking for in the Fallen Divas, but it's not an easy place to be, because Byron is full of attitude and the Divas are a group of trans people who have all different attitudes and different attitudes to Byron.
Oh, absolutely. Byron is at first infatuated with Lady Di, who's the podium dancer that they come across in a Nottingham nightclub, and is the leader, de facto leader of the Fallen Divas. But nobody can keep the Divas in check. Like there's Sasha, for instance, played by Hannah Lane, who Byron and Sasha, they don't really see eye to eye, and that might lead to some arguments down the way. Yeah, so we follow Byron. We know from the book that before Paris Lees became a successful broadcaster and campaigner and journalist and a wonderful writer, that they landed themselves in some trouble along the way, that they did like a prison stretch for almost a year after a robbery. And there's constant flash forwards in the first few episodes to let you know that it's all going to go badly for Byron before it can go well. And that's what makes it such a difficult watch, because again, it's maybe been, you know, we were talking about this, maybe been marketed as a little bit of a cozy coming of age thing, but it is quite difficult to watch.
Yes, there are a series of bad boys that they meet that really,
which you're wondering if Byron is being taken advantage of because of their youth. They're only 15 and these people are older, and they're getting thrust into this quite adult world. And I think it's a look at that toughness and that strength that a lot of queer people need to survive in the world, and especially trans people. And I think that's very, you know, timely and necessary right now. But I do think the first three episodes are a tough watch, and it's not this you know, nostalgic look back. I don't think it is as cozy as it might
so
seem.
A tough watch, but a worthwhile watch.
Definitely. Yes. I think the performance from Ellis Howard as Byron is fantastic, and I think this is what we need to see more. When you see someone like Michael Socha, we know him from This Is England, and how fantastic it is to get those young working class actors who never have the chance really to be on screen, to find them, go out there and seek them out. And I think this is what's so important about these shows, to have that. It's not the same set of faces that you see all the time. And that's a legacy that needs to be in TV. And I think their performance is unbelievable.
And
really,
the people who are in the Fallen Divas, they are so strong. But then there's Callum, the Irish actor, Callum Lynch, who plays Max. Yeah. And then there's the bad boy.
Jake Dunn.
Who are all terrific.
Jake Dunn is fantastic, because playing a role where you can see that they are into the world of petty drug dealing and suck Byron into that world as well, but also have this weird push and pull relationship as a straight man, and Byron who's discovering themselves and discovering their sexuality. So it is about those dangers in a world where you're pushed to make these decisions where you might not, as I said, you're youthful and you're making these hard decisions trying to discover who you are.
Yeah. Okay, so as we said, we're only giving a taste of what it feels like for a girl because it's just a preview stage at the moment. So we're not giving any stars, but I think you're definitely recommending people to have a watch.
Definitely. I think it's an important show because from the outside looking in, it looks like just another show about a small town teenager looking for greener pastures. But this is a show on mainstream terrestrial television about the trans experience, and you don't get enough of that. And it's also wonderful to see that Ellis Howard, who's a relative newcomer on the screen, and in practically every scene, carrying a show like this, and as Jen says, getting the chance to do that, I think it's wonderful.
Unbelievably impressive. And I know we'll see more of Ellis Howard completely. And it's deeply moving, but also I will say, cracking salty humour in there as well.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Now, finally tonight, Netflix brings us Department Q, a crime thriller in which Matthew Good plays DC Carl Mork, a traumatised detective who heads up a new cold case unit that the police force hope will distract the public from their frequent failures. Tell us about the premise here, Jen.
I mean, there has been a lot of comparisons to Slow Horses with this. So I'm just going to get that out of the way. I mean, it's Scott Frank who was responsible for The Queen's Gambit, which was such a huge runaway success for Netflix. So you can understand why they want him at the helm of something like this. And they're both shows have similarities. Both are centred on these prickly leads. With Slow Horses, you have the brilliant Gary Oldman as the uncompromising Jackson Lamb. Mm. That's putting it mildly. Mm. And then in Q's case, there is Carl Mork, and he's played by Downton Abbey's Matthew Good. They're unpleasant characters. They're anti-authoritarian characters. And both have these mishmash misfits investigative teams that they have to form, and both operate in this dank kind of underworld.
Yes, this is the Department Q and Slow Horses comparison.
So
that's kind of where it stops, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a very different beast. And Department Q, it comes into being after Mork gets a young uniformed young officer killed and his own partner is paralysed by a bullet that passes through his neck then. And he's put on long-term leave. And when he returns, he's assigned to be the head of this new department investigating cold cases. So gradually he begins to assemble
Unsupportive to staff. He's not a likable character, the Matthew Good.
No, but those kinds of unlikable characters are usually fascinating to watch, and this is certainly the case. I think Matthew Good is an actor who has landed roles in the past that haven't been reflective of his talents. You know, he's had an awful lot of nothingy roles, basically. But here, there's a real sign.
He played Snowden in The Crown. He was quite good in that, I think.
He was actually quite good in that. But here, he can see that he's enjoying, you know, sinking his teeth into this tetchy, troublemaker, crime solver role who, again, is just sarcastic all the time. He has a superiority complex. You know, maybe feels as though he has to, you know, fill up every silence with something because he's the only Englishman in the room. You know, there is that kind of thing that where all of the other Scottish officers around him, because this thing is based in Edinburgh, don't like him. He thinks that he's not liked because he's an Englishman. But he's just, even when someone like his new partner, Akram, is supporting him, or even like Leah Burns-Rose, who is this desk worker, a cop who's been assigned to desk work because she had a breakdown in the field, but it's determined to prove herself. Even when she's helping him out, he's just not that nice to her. So
he has the most wonderful sidekick, though, hasn't he? Who he recruits. Akram,
yes.
Who is Syrian.
Yes.
And we fear he may have learned some of his techniques, torture techniques or encouragement techniques, maybe from the Assad regime. You never know.
I think he's the best character actually in it because he manages to undercut that perceived wisdom that Mork thinks he has at every turn. And he brings it back to the fact that he's like, I've seen a lot, you haven't. And he's very cool and level headed. And that's where you have that dynamic between the two of them. And he's very in control. Whereas I found Matthew Good's character, I really disliked him. And I found it very difficult to actually watch the series as it went on, because I think he's a very predictable anti-hero. He's arrogant and angry and renegade. But if you have someone, say, we've had anti-hero characters before in these dramas, like Robbie Coltrane's Fitz in Cracker, or even, you know, someone like Martin Freeman in The Responder, or David Tennant in Broadchurch. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But they all had this depth to them where they can be prickly, but they also have this underlying deepness to them. Whereas I found Matthew Good's character relentlessly annoying and very one note.
I think when
note.
He's with Akram, he in some ways, you know, softens down because the Matthew Good character does shout a lot.
Yeah, well, I think Akram starts to kind of kick back as well, two or three episodes in, because Moore thinks that he can walk in on Akram praying in their dank office, which is it used to be a toilet and a shower facility, and they've been given a budget. Well, the whole police department has been given a budget to, you know, get computers and screw whatever in here, and that budget has gone elsewhere. It's up to basically Moore to make the most of nothing. But he's walking in on Akram praying, and he interrupts him and tells him, "No, we need to get out." And then eventually Akram says, "You won't do that. You won't treat me like this," because Akram starts to show that although he has some unconventional methods, he could actually be quite helpful with Mark, and so too will Rose. And yeah, I agree. He is a terrible character, but again, I love watching him, and I love watching him in the scenes. He has to go to therapy. He has to go see a police therapist, and the police therapist is played by the brilliant Kelly MacDonald, who just gives him as good as she gets. Like if he mistreats her, or if he just doesn't want to talk, she gets up from her chair and has her lunch and waits for him to talk. You know, she has her own unconventional
methods. You mentioned the Queen's Gambit, Jen, and of course there is a parallel story here about Merritt Lingard, and that's played by Chloe Perry, who was in the Queen's Gambit.
Exactly. And during any moment when she is on screen, it's the highlight as well. I mean, I've her storyline runs parallel, so they're investigating this case around her, and she really holds your attention, I think, for the whole series. So I don't want to give away exactly what happens with her because it will be a spoiler, but I do have to say there is a lot of moving pieces in this thriller, and if you want the payoff at the ending to feel worth it, to feel impactful, you have to stay focused. There's a lot of threads going on here, so don't be scrolling at the same time, which I found more enjoyable than something like, say, Black Doves.
Never do, I know.
I did find this, it worked more successfully than something like Black Doves that we've seen earlier on. But I understand what you're saying about Matthew Good's character, but I still think we're being set up here for multiple seasons of this series. We definitely are. And hopefully it will broaden out his character as it goes on, because I love an anti-hero. I love bad guys, but at the same time, just tone it down. And Kelly MacDonald, I have to say, adds a great texture to that. She's a good foe.
Chris,
for him.
Stars out of five.
Yeah, Good clearly has his eyes on this running for years, because it's based on a Danish series of novels that were turned into films that have been going for 10 years. So I would actually like to see more of this. It's a great role for him, a great story. Stick with it. It is busy. There's a lot in it, but I'm going to go with 4.
And from you, Jen?
I'm going to say the finale is 71 minutes. A filmic 71 minutes, so strap yourself in. And I reckon it will learn from these initial mistakes and give us something more taught next time around, I would hope. So I'll give it 3.5.
Three and 4 out of 5 for Department Q. A listener says, "Oh, who cares if Aidan isn't plausible? Just look at him." Now, Department Q is available on Netflix. What It Feels Like for a Girl is on BBC One on Tuesday. And Just Like That is on Sky. And now, Jane Gannon and Chris Wasser, thank you so much. Our album reviews tonight has a lot of female chutzpah and defiance on show. Leading out is Garbage lead singer Shirley Manson, who has overcome physical disability to kick ass and shout truth to power in Let All That We Imagine Be the Light. Miley Cyrus is never afraid to kick ass. And in Something Beautiful, she struts her way through what she calls a visual album, as an accompanying film is to be released next month. But in a new album from Shura, Lovelorn Uncertainty and Anger is all bottled up in I Got Too Sad for My Friends. Kian O'Sullivan and Louise Bruton have been listening to these three albums, and let's begin with Garbage and the opening track of Let All That We Imagine Be the Light. This is There's No Future in Optimism.
If you're ready for love, if you're ready for love, if you're ready for love, if you're ready for love.
There's No Future in Optimism there from Let All That We Imagine Be the Light, and that's from Garbage. And I said Kian O'Sullivan and Louise Bruton are here, and they've both been listening. So Let All That We Imagine Be the Light is a very profound title for an album, isn't it, Kian? Mm. And then we have that track, There's No Future in Optimism, which doesn't kind of let an awful lot of light in. So mm-hmm. Where are Garbage now in 2025?
Yeah, so they've had a bit of tumult. So they were off the back of their album in 2021, which was called No Gods, No Masters, which was actually considered by a lot as a return to form. Pitchfork named it their best album since 1998's Version 2.0. There was a lot of speaking truth to power, as you said. There was a lot of sort of anger. There was a lot of take on socio-political topics. And I think they really got some momentum behind that, and they were trying to capitalise on it. And then they just kind of hit into roadblock after roadblock. You mentioned Shirley Manson's physical health.
What happened to her?
I think she had a hip replacement.
Oh, right, because she had some stage accident
fell, and then and then so she had to get some physical surgery. There was a second surgery as well. I don't have it in my notes as well. There was writer's block. Her poor dog passed away. So there was lots of, I guess, why are you laughing at that? There's lots of things that I guess were really impacting delivery of this album. They spoke about how they missed loads of deadlines, and yeah, I think that they kind of stumbled towards finally getting this all together.
So Louise, bring us into Garbage. Tell us a little bit about their background and where they are now.
So I suppose people will primarily know Garbage for Shirley Manson, who is a singer from Edinburgh, and she was in her own band in the 90s when she Butch Vig got in contact from her, an LA producer who is one of the masterminds behind Nirvana's Nevermind. He phoned her up and was like, we want you to sing with our band. And she didn't know who he was. And he was like, check the liner notes of Nevermind and you'll be convinced to come over. So she joined the band. And I think if they didn't have her, we probably wouldn't be still listening to the music of Garbage, because Shirley Manson manages to be very political but also very personal in the way that she gets her music across. Misogyny, queerness, power, coercion, paranoia, gender politics, these are things that she's been singing about for the past 30 years, and they are evergreen topics, especially now. Like that song, There's No Future in Optimism, I think that it's her attempt to try and heal the world with love, which sounds a bit woo-woo, but when the previous album was about trying to save the world, this album is about her trying to save herself. Because like Kian mentioned, she had multiple hip replacements. And on top of that, not just, you know, the frailty of your body, but the recovery, the brain fog, and the fact that she's now 58, she's had 30 years in front of a very, you know, misogynistic and then post-feminist media. And there's one song called Get Out of My Face, a.k.a. Bad Kitty. Terrible title, but which is kind of a direct call to action against this misogyny that she has experienced for the entirety of her career. But she opens up that umbrella for other people who are marginalised, especially in America where she lives.
Yes, Kian, I think you mentioned the track Sisyphus, which was the idea of Shirley pushing this boulder up a hill. And that idea, as Louise has explained there, what has happened to her, you can imagine that that is very pertinent to
yeah
to
exactly
her
look
experience.
I do I'm hesitant when I see such a literal metaphor as Sisyphus, because she's pushing the boulder up the hill, and look, spoiler alert, it never gets there. But yeah, this kind of comes in a sonic reprieve on the album as well. I think it's quite one of my favorite kind of sounds on the album. It has pop swirls, as is like glitchy percussive synth, cascading kind of bleeps and boops. And I guess
yes, because you feel it was very metallic and very, you know, like the track we
heard. We just heard
there, very noisy.
Yeah, it's kind of dystopian, it's kind of futuristic, apocalyptic as well. So yeah, I think she's taking some time to be generous to herself, I think, on that track, and acknowledging the struggle that she's been going through. On a similar topic as well, I think Chinese Fire Horse is a song where she talks about people who've been judging her body and her age and telling her what she can and can't do, and it's kind of just a middle finger to them. So there is a lot of defiance in this record.
Now, I think we all agree that The Day I Met God is a great track. Will you talk us into that one, Louise?
Yeah, so this is the closing track on the album, and it's a real big personal narrative of her having to kind of face the reality of who she is, and having probably had to think quite seriously about her life and if death is on her doorstep. It doesn't it reflects the kind of questions that the album has been tackling on, kind of like, are you happy with everything that you've achieved so far in your life? And she says, when it's all over, it was everything I ever wanted. So everything that she has gone through with being in garbage, with being Shirley Manson, with going through the numerous kind of health issues she's had, she wouldn't change a thing. And it's a very powerful ending track.
In the middle of the day when I met God, my life and mind.
That's The Day I Met God from Let All That We Imagine Be the Light from Garbage. So, Cian, again, Louise was saying there about there's that whole idea of saving the world to saving herself in terms of Manson. How do you feel that these two themes, this personal and this global one, work together in this album?
Yeah, I think you can tell she's trying to work through her demons, so to speak. And, you know, I can't deny the emotional vulnerability that's at play in some scenarios. But sometimes I just felt the delivery was just kind of deadpan, like that track, Get Out of My Face, Bad Kitty. I felt the delivery was so deadpan that I was like, where's the attitude? You know, she's supposed to be angry. I felt she was kind of delivering it all in kind of one note. And I found that kind of frustrating. I wanted to hear the emotion in her voice rather than just the words of those emotions.
Okay, stars out of 5 from you, Cian.
Yeah, unfortunately, it didn't get there for me. It's only 2.5.
And from you, Louise?
3 for me. Thematically, I think it's great, but it's actually Shirley Manson's husband, Billy Bush, who produced this. And I feel like he maybe didn't match the grit that Shirley has been experiencing.
It's all his fault.
Yeah. Damn it, Billy.
Yeah, get it together. Okay, now to Miley Cyrus and her 9th album, Something Beautiful, and this is Walk of Fame. That's Walk of Fame from Something Beautiful by Miley Cyrus. So Louise, this is her 9th album. And of course, her previous album had the break or that huge single, Flowers, that everybody was either singing, dancing to or sending to broken lovers to. Tell us, is it more of the same we have here?
Miley Cyrus, for the entirety of her adult career, has done this very unusual thing where she will have huge success. The example of Flowers, which was a song that got her first Grammy win ever, since she's been performing since she's been the age of like 10 or 11. Yeah. So 20 plus years of being in the limelight. So any success she has, when she has the next opportunity to match that, she completely rejects the format that had gone before her. There was a brilliant review of the album in The Guardian today, and Alexis Petridis, he coined it perfectly. She has this tendency to go wildly off-piste, and this is what she has done now again with this album. Instead of going for the very kind of radio-friendly pop hit, she's going for these 6-minute disco odysseys like this one, The Walk of Fame, that we just heard there, which has elements of kind of Giorgio Moroder or Duran Duran. It's very camp, it's very high fashion, but they are big songs that are made to be listened to on an album rather for being played on daytime radio, which probably isn't the smartest move for somebody like Miley Cyrus, and will probably go against everything that people expect from Miley to do next. So I think this album and these songs, it'll take a while for people to set into them. But once you get rid of the idea of she needs to have these 3-minute pop bangers, this is an impressive album. It's an expensive album. You can just hear the amount of kind of musicians that are kind of contributing to this large, lush sound. And I think it is, when she does allow herself to be a bit more fun in this album, she's probably one of the biggest stars out there, and she shines so brightly on songs like The Walk of Fame.
Cian?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think she's getting a bit of flack because she compared herself to Pink Floyd in this. And I think people have taken that too literally. You know, she's spoken about how big of an influence Roger Waters has been on her. But he kind of only informs the first half of the album. The second album is pure Giorgio Moroder. And she is kind of taking it into a big sort of disco style. And again, they're not mainstream disco. It's like dark disco. She's like the lady of the night when it comes to dancing. She's choosing to make an artistic statement, I think, this time. Whereas before, I think she's kind of stumbled into her success and then built a sort of album around it. I think this is her chance to go for a big cinematic swing. She's releasing a movie to go along with this album, talking about expensive. And, you know, it's really ornamentally instrumentated. There's these conceptual outros to songs. There's these jazzy, cacophonous interludes. She's really trying to make the gestures of a big pop opera or this sort of album of the ages.
Almost. Right. And are there singles that stand out from you? For you in it, or tracks that stand out for you, maybe not as big as Flowers, but it's similar.
I think Easy Lover is could easily be one of the biggest songs from it. It's going to be interesting to see how people react to it now that it's out. It's kind of like line dance disco. It was written for Beyonce's Cowboy Carter. She rejected it, but I think it's great to hear Miley's voice on it. I don't know if Beyonce would have done as good of a job, but I love Beyonce. I'm not having a go at her. I also love Every Girl You've Ever Loved as well. That song is so propulsive. It's like the dial of 1980s is all the way up. It has this outro nodding to Madonna's Vogue, voiced by Naomi Campbell. So yeah, that's also another big moment on the record.
Right. And for you, were there standout tracks, Louise?
Yeah, there's one song called Reborn, which is like a disco hymn. And I just think it's such a big, big song. And it's a great example of what it is that Miley can achieve. It's big, it's expensive, but it's also very simple in its lyrics. Because I think when she goes for trying to be quite deep, which I think More to Lose, and then the opening track, which is a spoken word interlude, it's terrible. When she tries to be too smart, it doesn't work. But I think when she just goes with a more kind of carefree approach to writing lyrics, I think it works so well. And Reborn is one of those. And she has access to the best producers, the best musicians, and Reborn is an example of that.
So stars out of five for you, for Miley Cyrus. Louise?
3.5/4. I'm undecided. Okay. Teetering.
And Kian?
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I think as I listened to it when the day went on, I was leaning more towards 3.5. I think I wanted these songs to be slightly stickier, but has potential to go back to 4.
Okay, so that's Miley Cyrus, and we've one more album, Shura, but that's after the break.
RTE Radio 1.
Hey! Aiken Promotions presents...
Hey, Soul Sister!
Train.
Oh, I swear to you, I'll be there for you.
Live at Ivy Gardens, July 6th, subject to venue license.
Tell me, did the wind sweep you off your feet? Did you finally get the chance today?
Tickets available now.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
All access to Audi is all yours with the 252 Audi range. Enjoy exhilarating test drives, exciting offers, introductory incentives, and exclusive product packs for a limited time during Audi All Access in dealerships nationwide. Discover all the advantages to owning a new Audi this summer. Terms and conditions apply. Audi. Vorsprung durch Technik.
Make real summer savings this bank holiday weekend at SuperValu. Like SuperValu Fresh Irish Triploin Steak, save 25%. Signature Taste Range, 2 for €8. Coke, Doritos and Cadbury Selected Ranges, 3 for €5. And scan your Real Rewards card or app and get Coke 18-can packs, €10. Make real summer savings this bank holiday weekend at SuperValu. DRS applies.
As I learn about my autism diagnosis, as I look for support for my autistic child, as I find new friends in the autism community, as I speak up for myself, As I Am is here to support autistic people and family members at each stage of life, because every autistic person deserves the same chance. Call As I Am's Autism Information Line team at 0818 234 234 or visit asiam.ie and find the answers to your questions. Supported by the HSE.
Metallica in the round. The M72 World Tour continues. Live from the halfway line at Aviva Stadium, June 2026. two nights, two different sets, a no-repeat weekend. Night one, special guests Pantera and Avatar. Night two, Gojira and Knopf Loose. Two-day tickets, $121.25 to $261.25 on sale now. Additional charges will apply, subject to license. Metallica.
You're listening to Friday Night's Arena, and we're in the middle of our album reviews. Kian O'Sullivan and Louise Bruton have been listening to new albums from Garbage and Miley Cyrus, and now we have Shura, and her new album is called I Got Too Sad for My Friends. Let's listen to The World's Worst Girlfriend. That's World's Worst Girlfriend from Shura, and her album is called I Got Too Sad for My Friends. And Kian O'Sullivan and Louise Bruton have listened to that. Kian, tell us a little bit about Shura. She's had a rough time.
Like Shirley Manson has had a bit of a rough time as well. So Shura broke through in kind of 2015, 2016 when she uploaded a song onto the internet that she just kind of like did on her spare time, made this song, put it up, and loads of pop blogs loved it, and she gained a lot of traction. She released the critically acclaimed album Nothing's Real in 2016, and then she was dropped from her major record label that was kind of signing her following the hype. She signed up to another one. 2019's Forever came out, also critically acclaimed. It was more kind of groovy and joyous, and that also saw her dropped from her record label. So she's been dropped twice, and this was right at the onset of the pandemic. So she's basically been since then navigating the pandemic, which is difficult for all of us, and then kind of coming from a place of kind of also having bouts of depression, feeling creatively stifled. She's kind of looked to other ways of finding creativity. She became a Twitch streamer. She streamed playing Dungeons and Dragons sort of games. And she's slowly come around to writing this record, which is not from a place of sadness, but very much reflecting on a time of sadness that she just came through.
All right. So she just kind of locked herself away. I mean, pretty awful to be dropped by two different record labels.
Yeah, I mean, you'd almost give up. They try to twist her arm. Yeah. But the depression is real on this album. And at times, Shura is very aware of it, but it's also the self-awareness is also there, but it's also quite self-indulgent. There's a track, Recognize, and she says of that song that Arthur Russell sang, being sad is not a crime. And then she kind of took this moment to lock herself away with a book and a cup of tea. And part of me is a bit like, isn't that well for you to be able to, if that's your version of kind of coping, it sounds like a regular day for everybody else. So the themes of it aren't really that big, but
and very self-indulgent, you would think, or you would say.
I feel like she hadn't left the room for a while, and you can hear that
she's gaming, according to Kian.
She is, exactly.
Yeah, there's the song America where she brings up kind of the death of George Floyd, and then she kind of brings it back to her own sadness, and I just feel
all right.
that's a kind of a meander we could have done without.
All right. Well, Kian, what do you think? I mean, is she in danger of the third record dumping?
Well, look, the last two are great. So, I mean, if she does, maybe she only gets dumped if she does something right. I think what she's brought on this album is more of a diaristic approach to her lyricism. I mean, there's a line that I really loved from Tokyo, which was just like it read straight out of her diary. In the bar, I asked you why you're always on your phone, and you told me you think you'd like me more to be more confident. I think you meant it in a good thing, but it sounded so mean, like you wish you were somebody in a different body. You could imagine that being read from her diary.
And right,
I think
yes,
the
yeah.
way she, and that's kind of a new approach for her. I also think the way she makes these songs, I think they are self-indulgent because she's being incredibly introspective. I feel like she makes a really spacious production and then gives herself a small space in the centre as if you're kind of in her head. Mm. And I think she did that really, really well. Like, I think she...
But there'd be lots of people who would identify with that.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Absolutely.
But do they make good songs?
The people who identify?
No, sorry. Do her diaristic ramblings make good songs?
Well, I think it's not just a lyrical approach. I really enjoy the kind of instrumentation on this. There's some jazzy flourishes, you know, there's some lots of brass. I think she like layers textures really, really well. There's really gorgeous instrumentation. And that kind of picks up, I think, towards the end of the record. You have If You Don't Believe in Love, which is aided by the Latin folk musician Helado Negro, which has a lot more sway to it. I Want to Be Loved actually felt like an American style standard. I thought that was very sort of uplifting. So I think, like, what maybe she lacks in outer vision, she makes up in instrumentation.
So Keane, stars out of five.
I really, really enjoyed this. Maybe one of my favourite records of the year, 4.5.
All right. Oh, Louise.
I feel like a meanie. No, it's about 3 stars for me. I just feel like sometimes you need to take a walk and take in the world outside, and this album could have done with a stroll or two.
Okay, well, that's sure as I got too sad for my friends. Before that, we heard Miley Cyrus, Something Beautiful, and then before that, Garbage, Let All That We Imagine Be the Light. Keane O'Sullivan and Louise Bruton, thank you so much.